The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. I'd like to welcome to the program today J.R. Helton. He joins us on the telephone in San Antonio, Texas. Hello, J.R.
Hello, Vic. Good to talk to you.
J.R., you have a memoir out. It's called
Bad Jobs.
And Poor Decisions.
And Poor Decisions.
Dispatches from the Working Class.
Right.
And you know, I hate to say this to you, J.R., because maybe it wasn't intended this way, but I thought this book was hilarious.
Oh, no. I'm so glad you got that, because it's supposed to be funny. I mean, it's dark humor. It's definitely dark humor.
Okay.
But it's supposed to be funny, and there's parts of this that still make me laugh to this day. Some of the dialogue still cracks me up.
Well, what made you decide to write about this subject?
Well, all of my books, this is the fourth book I've published in English, and I published a couple in France, which are basically collections of these works. And translations, but all of my work is based on my life. So, really, all of my books are autobiographical novels or memoirs, you know. So, I write to try to figure out, for personal reasons, to try to figure out what happened in my life, but also to try to tell a story as well, you know, with narrative elements, obviously. And so, this was just an area of my life. My 20s, you know, which actually was a tough time to write about, you know, to get perspective on. It took me a long time to get some perspective on that era because it was such an aimless kind of, you know, confusing time, you know, in my life, my 20s.
You grew up in a little community outside of Austin. Tell us about this place.
I spent my later teenage years in a small hill country town outside of Austin. That's been in three of my books now. I always call it Cypress.
Oh.
But I don't care. It's really Wimberley, Texas, which is very well-known, beautiful little tourist area, tourist town, and just real pretty hill country town not far from Austin. And I always call it Cypress. I mean, I've called it Cypress in my novel, The Jugheads, my autobiographical novel, fictionalized memoir, Drugs. And then in this book as well, I call it Cypress, but it's really Wimberley, Texas.
The name has been changed to protect the guilty.
Yeah, the guilty and the innocent. You know, I'm just trying to disguise kind of a little bit some things, you know, especially about my first wife, because I didn't want to, you know, it's kind of a dicey thing to write about.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Okay, so give our listeners some idea of some of these bad jobs and poor decisions. And I don't want to give it all away, but I do want to talk about some of these bad jobs because, man, you had some really bad jobs.
I know. I made some really poor decisions. As I said at the beginning of the book, my books, they actually were published out of order. This is part of a trilogy. And they should have been published. The first one should have been The Jugheads, which is my life up until I was about 18. And then this book, Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, and then my book, Drugs. So all this is really the second part of a trilogy, but it was published as the third.
Oh.
And so I had at the end of The Jugheads, which ends really in a pretty bad situation, which was based on my real life, you know, I got a scholarship to UT Austin and, you know, academic, and I was, was on the path to, you know, and I was in this big honors program there and all this stuff, and I was going to be a doctor, but I really wanted to be a writer because I'd always been an artist all my life. I'd always been an artist. I'd always been writing stories and things like that since I was 8 years old. So I met Dr. Betty Sue Flowers, who I acknowledged at the end of this book in the acknowledgments, and she just had a huge influence on me, introducing me to the world of literature and just a combination of elements came together where I was like, you know, she said, what do you really want to do? I said, I really want to be a writer. And she was like, well, it'll be the hardest thing you'll ever do, but you should, if that's what you want to do, you should try to do that if you don't want to be a doctor. And that's all I needed to hear, you know, this overachieving 18-year-old, you know, was that that would be the hardest thing I could do, to be a writer. So I decided to do that. And I published, as I said at the beginning of this book, I did publish one of my first few, it wasn't my first short story, but it was like, you know, when I was 19, 20 years old or so. And it won a Pushcart Prize, and I just thought, man, this is going to be easy. This writing thing's going to be easy. And I had all these, you know, professors helping me and offering me, you know, if I stayed in college, you know, a place in their graduate program, you know, these big creative writing programs and stuff. And instead, I got real cocky and quit college, and I ended up, I kept writing for all of those years, but I never really published anything for like 15 years. So I ended up being in and out of college for much of my 20s, and then finally ended up getting a degree, but it took me a long time. It took me like, God, nine years to get my undergraduate degree.
So you took a long detour.
I did. I really did it the hard way, and I could have done it in a much easier way. And also, I was really arrogant at the time, and I didn't listen to editors at big literary magazines, that, you know, the few of them that I was dealing with, that the changes they were asking for, like I think I mentioned this in the book too, like I was writing plays then too, and these directors I was working with and these editors, I realize now that they weren't that big, you know, that I should have gone along with some of them, and some, even some of the agents too, but I was just so, you know, I was like, this, you know, it's, I was, you know, this is my art. This is what I'm doing. You know, it's going to have to be this way, you know. So it's really pretty inflexible. I think that might have been another reason why I didn't publish stuff for a while, because it had such a big chip on my shoulder, you know.
You had difficulty allowing an editor to touch your stuff or to make suggestions.
I did. I still do.
Well, that's understandable. I get it, because you're right and they're wrong, right?
Yeah, I mean, unless they can give me something really specific, which I was with this book, I was lucky. I had a couple of good editors, and you know, and then also with my book Drugs, I had a good, and Jughead, I had a good editor, and she was able to give me real specific suggestions with Drugs and Jugheads, and same thing with Will Miniker and Phil Marino with Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions. Good specific suggestions. So if you can do that, but when some of these agents, you know, these editors, they'll give you these really vague, you know, like I didn't like your, you know, I thought the ending was too sad or something, you know, just like some vague, you know, it needs to be more upbeat or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm just like, you know, forget it.
My guest is J.R. Helton. His book is Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class. He joins us on the phone in San Antonio, Texas. J.R., I just heard you say that these were published out of order, and I looked you up, and I saw where the book Drugs, which you say would be the third book in the trilogy.
Yes.
Wasn't that actually the first book you published?
That was the first one. Well, actually, the first book I published was this underground cult movie book called Below the Line, which not many people know about unless you're in the movie business. And that was how Robert Crumb and I became friends, actually. I had an agent and a number of people interested in that book when I wrote the first edition in 1995, 96. And I'd worked on 25 movies as a lead scenic artist, and I was at the top of that game, and the movie game is a scenic artist in Texas. And I wrote this book. Yeah, I worked, Lonesome Dove was my first movie. In fact, that's the movie in this book, by the way. I call it The Cry of the Plane. But it's really,
I wondered about that.
Yeah. But anyway, that was my first show, and my last one was a movie called Michael, Nora Ephron picture in 96. But anyway, I'd written this memoir that was really scathing and bitter about the film business, and had a lot of interest in it, but all these agents wanted me to change it. And so just some couple friends of mine in the film business who work below the line, we just published it ourselves. And this was back before the internet, before, you know, any of this stuff, you know, everything was print, you know, nothing digital. And we sold out like 3,000 copies. We got a real good distributor, sold out the first two printings, and somehow that one of those fell into the hands of Terry Zweigoff, the director of the movie Crumb. He had just made the film Crumb, and then he gave it to Robert Crumb, who was at his house, And he loved it, and they called me on the phone, and Crumb said, listen, I want to paint a cover for this book. And Terry said, I'll write an introduction for it. We're going to really try to help you get this book published. And that was in 97, 98, and it took another couple of years. And then Ron Turner at Last Gasp Books and Gary Groth at Fantagraphics Books, those two guys wanted to publish it, and Ron Turner got it first. So at Last Gasp, so we ended up going with him. So a lot of, like I said, it's unless like people buy that book and pass it around on movie sets and stuff, but there were only 2,000 copies of it printed in that second edition, so not many people know about it. But so then, long answer to your question, I published several short stories between then and when Drugs was accepted in like 2010, and then it was published, sections of it were published in France actually first in 2011, some pieces of it. And then it was published in 2012 by Seven Stories Press and distributed by Random House in 2012, Drugs was. So,
was it published in France because that's where Crumb lives?
Yeah, well, my agent is Crumb's agent.
Okay.
And so Laura is she lives in Paris. She's an expatriate who lives in Paris.
I see.
And she's married to Gilbert Shelton, if you know.
Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers.
Yeah, that's her husband.
Never heard of him.
Right. So they actually then published a French full edition of Drugs, but they changed the title in 2013 to Voyage à bout de la Blanche. And I don't speak French, but that means journey to the end of the white, and La Blanche is a slang on the street for cocaine or heroin in French.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. My guest is J.R. Helton, and we're going to keep talking about bad jobs and poor decisions right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. J.R. Helton is my guest. His new book is Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class. We were talking about your connection with R. Crumb. It looks like he did the cover for Drugs, too.
Yeah, he did the cover for Below the Line. He did the cover for Drugs, and he actually did two covers for my book, The Jugheads. He did this one cover, the first cover, not that I don't like his second cover, but the first cover was incredible. I mean, it's just really, it was a really realistic rendering, one of his, you know how he does his really realistic renderings, but it, also his artistic interpretation of what my family looked like. But apparently it looked too close to my family, and so they called my publisher in New York and basically threatened to sue.
Your family did?
Yeah. They, my father did.
Oh,
and
ouch.
If you made the Jugheads, you might get an inkling of what my, you know, my relationship had been like for years with my dad. So
yeah,
they were really upset. And so Robert never does. I mean, he doesn't do covers for anybody.
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, I'm very lucky that believes he's one of my biggest fans, you know, but and a friend. But he agreed to do a second cover, which was really surprising to me. So the cover that's on the Jugheads that came out in 2014 is really the second one. So yeah, he's done four covers for me, and he also wrote a long introduction to a collection of my work in France called A Texas, Tu seras déjà mort, which means something like, if you're in Texas, you'd be dead already. Which, don't ask me why they picked that title.
Okay. Well, JR, let's talk about some of your experiences in this new book, Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You apparently liked drugs. Obviously, you had a book about drugs.
Yeah.
You used a lot of drugs.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm going to try so hard not to be the stereotypical writer complaining about reviews, but you know, Kirk is really, those guys really don't like my books, and they slammed this one for my pot, for smoking so much pot in this book. And I have to tell you, Vic, that I didn't even think about, I mean, when I wrote this book, I was just, I mean, yes, I did. I smoked way too much pot back then, but it didn't even really occur to me, you know, when I was writing. I was like, yeah, so we were smoking, you know, pot all the time, you know, just, it wasn't something that I thought even, that I even really noticed. To me, I was just like, yeah, I was smoking too much, you know, because basically during that time period, I was unhappy at those jobs that I was at, you know, and it makes it a lot easier if you're, you know, painting an industrial warehouse floor all day to be high, you know, especially if you know what you're doing, and you can just smoke a little bit, you know, you're not like falling down wasted or anything.
That is so hilarious when you talk about that. You had some sort of lethal varnish or floor sealant that you were applying, and you guys didn't have any respirators or protective equipment, and you're waiting for the last guy to show up. And this last guy,
Colin,
the boxer, what a character.
Yeah, that's real, man. That's all true. And that's really important, his dialogue, actually, the stuff he said about being in Palestine and his, when the British pulled out. And, you know, that guy really was there. And I mean, I don't know, those stories that he told. I mean, I actually looked, before I published that book, and I looked up the incidents between Israelis and Palestinians and when the British were withdrawing. And some of those, there were horrible incidents of, you know, massacres and slaughters on each side as people were going back and forth across those porous borders around that time that Egypt was supposed to be guarding, I think, as well as the British. And so I actually checked those stories of his. And
he really was Irish, and he really was there with the British, wasn't he?
He was right there, he was. And I remember researching that back in the late 90s when I was first working on that story. I worked on this book, actually, started work on this book. This has pieces of stuff that I wrote in my late 20s, that I wrote in the 90s, and then I finished up, you know, a few years ago. So it's got material that spans over 20 years easily.
Was that helpful because then you were able, since you started writing it so long ago, to remember more accurately?
Right. Yeah, I really save all my stuff. I really, for all writers, I teach writing and creative writing sometimes, and I always encourage my students to save everything, you know, and to print it out too. So I found old print copies of stories that I'd written that had, that I could draw upon for sections of this dialogue. That's why, you know, so much of it is really verbatim from that time period, because I'd written it not long after I'd been working at those paint jobs, you know.
I think
or selling pumpkins.
Yeah, if I had to pick a favorite job, that would be the one. The pumpkins, the firewood, the grass.
Halloween.
Tell us about this guy you were working for and what you were doing.
Yeah, Danny. That's one of my favorite sections in the book, Halloween. And I was selling. He had these fly-by-night businesses that pop up. I don't know if that happens up in Ohio, but in Texas they're all over the place. And they pop up along I-10 and I-30, major interstates and stuff, you know. And they'll have a bunch of rocks out there, and some guy will have a little construction trailer, and it says, you know, Mike's Rocks, you know, or something like that. And this guy was Danny's Grass and Wood, and he basically just was trying to sell dead pallets of St. Augustine grass and, you know, trying to make a buck any way he could. And I was really trying to be critical of actually a business of capitalism in that story in a way. And this guy who's willing to, who's obviously an incredibly cruel, racist person, you know, exploiting everybody who works for him. He almost got me killed in that one scene where I busted my hand really bad under that semi.
Yeah, I think you could have won the Darwin Award for that particular escapade. In fact,
yeah, that was really, oh my God, I got lucky.
I hate to admit this, but it's so gory and it's so brilliantly described. Even though you've suffered this terrible injury, I kept laughing. I'm sorry.
It's funny when he takes me to a dentist's office instead of an emergency room. I get out of the truck and I'm bleeding, and he's like, "Get back in the truck." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "This is a dentist's office. It's not an emergency room." he was just this hustler guy. You know, I mean, just a sleazy hustler guy. And you know, I think it's funny the scene where he meets an even bigger criminal, Johnny Florida, who's selling used cars and turning back the mileage on them. And then that guy rips him off, rips off these two big car dealership people in town. And, you know, Danny did have a gun there in his desk. And, you know, he was smoking dope all day, and I was smoking it too with him. And, you know, he's just a shyster.
Uh-huh. Well, I like how after you suffered that horrible, gruesome injury, and you weren't able to use one of your arms for a long time, he kept getting mad at you.
He was serious.
Because you couldn't use your arm that you injured because of him.
Right, right. He's like, did you really need that cast? Do you really need that cast? And then he didn't want to pay. I put that in the book. He didn't want to pay for the, I only got like one small prescription of pain pills in the very beginning when it happened. And it's actually very painful. And he didn't want to pay for it. And then he took some of them. He's like, give me some of those.
Did you really suffer that injury to your hand?
I mean, I did pretty bad, but they sewed my thumb back together, so I have my thumb is there, but I did the top of my middle finger is missing.
Oh, man.
That was cut off, and I broke my two fingers really bad and my right thumb really bad and my wrist and it did scrape up all the skin on top of my hand, although it looks, you know, normal now, but my finger's a little crooked and it still hurts because I write by hand and then I type stuff up. So it actually still hurts.
And that's your primary hand?
Yeah, my right hand. Oh. Yeah. So my handwriting sucks.
Well,
but
it's a miracle you weren't hurt more badly.
My head was over, as I described. My head was actually over that leaf spring at first. And to try to, you know, I was just an ignorant, you know, 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid. I don't know. You know, I was really young. I didn't know anything about what I was doing. But he should have known. You know, he should have known that. The pressure was on that leaf spring. Tens of thousands of pounds of pressure were on that, and if I loosened the bolt on top of it, that it could have, you know, exploded. Steel exploding everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I got to give you credit because I read it and I was appalled by the gruesomeness of your injury, but I kept laughing. I reread it 3 or 4 times and just kept laughing because it was so funny. And to be able to describe this horror that happened to you and make it funny, that's a gift.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. That's the last chapter is my favorite, Finding the Cure for Cancer. And like I said, the dialogue in that, just those two guys, David and I can't remember, I changed his name to Ray, I think. Those two guys were really funny. I mean,
this is the floor varnishing crew.
Yeah, they were like an Abbott. They really were like an Abbott and Costello routine. And they knew who – they weren't just completely stereotypical dumb guys either, you know. I mean, they knew who Abbott and Costello were. You know, that's the point of that joke when he makes – he says, I feel like I'm in the Who's on First routine, you know. And then Colin's like, who? What?
Right. Well, the dialogue is spot on. Like, I kept thinking – how does he remember this dialogue? There was one part in there that I won't get into detail, but this guy's describing some kind of sexual escapade that he claims that he was involved in. And it was just so horrifying and strange, but it sounded real.
He told those kind of stories all the time, which I think I have him telling like 2 of them, you know. And they're graphic, you know. It's graphic,
yeah.
It's gross, you know. It's gritty. But that's the way these guys talk on construction sites, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth, you know.
Yeah.
So, that guy's dead. He died. Ironically, that guy died. The guy who says, you know, oh, he keeps saying we're gonna get cancer from this stuff. We're gonna get cancer from this stuff.
Very believable.
We did.
That stuff sounded incredibly toxic.
And it was lacquer. That was lacquer, man. Uh-huh. That's crazy. I can't believe we even do that. You know, I mean, lacquer fumes are the most deadly around. That and kills, but. You know,
it's true.
Stupid.
And here you are. You're still here. You're able to talk about it. Somebody's watching out for you.
Okay. Yeah, well, I quit.
Can we talk about your first wife?
Yeah.
Because she's in the book a lot.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
and her mother.
Yeah, her mom's in there. Actually, I put her mom in there more because she's supposed to be indicative of her. So I thought that was a better way to do it,
uh-huh.
To show that this is basically what his life would be like, that Jake, myself, had these two paths that I could have gone on. And then, so that's why that Sweetheart of the Rodeo section is so long and so like the slice of life kind of thing, because it's supposed to represent like, okay, here's the other path that he could take with his wife. This is what it would entail. And these are the people, these are the way people, the way they talk and what they're doing. And then I juxtapose that. I purposely sandwiched that in between, you know, especially made that before Finding the Cure for Cancer to show this stark difference between these two worlds. And I ended up choosing the latter one with the working construction and with those guys.
And your first wife, she's the one who got you into the film industry because she was very interested in it. And as readers, we're reading this and we're saying to ourselves, she's not being faithful to JR, but it's like you're the last guy to know.
Well, I'm not being I'm not being faithful to her. I mean, I tried to show that I'm, you know, was not a good husband, you know. And that, so that, I mean, we were both, you know, fooling around on each other. And And basically at the end, I think, personally, just like honestly, I think I was somewhat hypocritical and like, you know, it's like a not a big deal if I was cheating on her, you know, but mm-hmm. she's cheating on me. Suddenly, oh, I'm all pissed off.
The old double standard.
Yeah, the old double standard. So I was, you know, and actually they, my editors asked me to add the prologue and the epilogue to the book. So that last scene, they said, you've got to tell us after finding a cure for cancer. Like, you've got to tell us what happened to you two, you know? And I was like, okay, well, I, you know, write about 10 pages or so, you know, kind of summarizing what happened in that period, you know? But actually, she and I did see each other again, and I don't wish her any ill will. And, you know, she's had a very successful life in the film business, and I wish her the best, you know.
Was her father or was it stepfather really a famous person like you describe?
He was, yeah. And that one's kind of harder to disguise. And Jughead's, I made him a professional basketball player, but I just went ahead and said he was a football player in this one. But
He was a basketball player.
Yeah. Well,
but we don't know who he is?
It's pretty easy to figure it out if you...
Who was he?
He wrote a...
Call the lawyers.
He wrote a big famous novel about one of the first big famous novels about professional sports that was made into a big movie in the late 70s. I mean, big feature film that was very successful. I met him as a teenager at the height of his fame, what turned out to be the height of his fame, and right before he started to have a really nasty divorce. But what's kind of, you know, it's not in the book. You can't put everything in there.
Yeah. He was an NBA player?
And after, like, those scenes where he and I are on the phone and stuff like that, that is the kind of stuff that he said to me, I mean, verbatim. Mm-hmm. But, and he was threatening them and everything, but I actually went up and coached one of his son's basketball. I was a big basketball player, and I went up to where he lived and coached one of his kids' basketball games. And I was a referee for one of his son's basketball games, and you know, talked to him. I saw him a couple times up in his home, Northeastern State, which is not really Ohio, I should say. I said he was in Ohio, but
yeah,
it was another big Eastern.
Was he NBA or ABA?
He was NFL.
Oh, so he was a football player.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you said he was a basketball player.
Well, I said he was a basketball player in my book, The Jugheads.
Oh, okay, I get it.
And he was still alive when I wrote The Jugheads, so that was one reason why I said he was a professional basketball player then, is because I thought that book was going to get published and he was still alive, but he died a few years ago.
Huh.
But he had a huge influence on me looking back over it, obviously. I mean, and I put that in the book that I'd always been an artist. I draw, you know, and paint and stuff, and I talk about that some in the book. But I met this real writer, you know, I saw this real writer, and that was another mistake, poor decision on my part, because I thought he was indicative of all writers, you know. I thought every writer had movie stars call him on the phone, and the Today Show came, you know, I remember being in high school and the Today Show taped on their back porch or whatever, you know, talking to him and, you know, they compared to my, you know, pretty straight-laced, you know, middle-class parents, they're partying all the time and having fun. And he just, like I said in the book, he did whatever he wanted to do. You know, he's a big gun nut.
Sounds like Jerry Kramer.
No.
Okay. But, okay, yeah. I'm just guessing.
No.
Okay.
I'm telling you, it's just, if you just look at the late 70s, it's pretty much the biggest book. It was the first one, the biggest one about the sport that was made into a movie. And so I saw that.
Well, it wasn't George Plimpton, I know that.
No. Okay. No, this guy was a big guy. He was a big.
Okay.
I mean, he wasn't that big in his sport, but he became very famous for what he wrote about it, the book he wrote about it.
I see.
Which turned out to be his biggest book of his career. In fact, he was frustrated that he had to keep writing about sports, and that was the only thing that got published. I know that. But he said that to me.
Our listeners are Googling right now madly trying to solve this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is J.R. Helton. His book is Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class. We're going to talk about some more of these bad jobs right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to be joined on the program today by J.R. Helton. His book, Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class, just came out. He joins us on the telephone in San Antonio, Texas.
Yep.
You write for a living. You teach writing. You take a long time to write your books. Your books come out in different orders. You're constantly being questioned by lawyers and publishers about your stuff you're writing. You sound like a troublesome fellow.
Yeah, no. I'm actually pretty – my life has never been more stable, man. I've been at the University of Texas at San Antonio for, God, 17 years now.
Uh-huh.
And I teach, you know, rhetoric, but I also teach creative writing for the Honors College, and I've gotten a lot more done. I mean, I've more books published and things published since my life settled down around the early 2000s. It's actually pretty staid existence. Although if you read my book Drugs, you know, it's definitely pretty wild. Drugs is pretty crazy, that book.
Drugs.
Yeah, my biographical or fictionalized memoir, which is what they were calling it, Seven Stories Press.
And weren't they comparing it to weren't they comparing it to the first William Burroughs book?
It was they were, and that's great because that was intentional. I completely admit that I was copying two books: Huxley's Doors of Perception, mm-hmm, and William S. Burroughs' Junkie. I mean, and Burroughs admits freely that he was copying or, you know, imitating out of appreciation a book called You Can't Win by Jack Black, which is a great book about a burglar and opiate addict in the 1920s. And so I was really inspired by Junkie, and Junkie is exactly what the format that Drugs imitates, where I had this real deadpan monotone going through, you know, my experiences with drugs. And I was trying to strike a blow against the war on drugs and to use myself as this example and say that, look, you know, I've done all these drugs all my life, and that actually I'm just fine. I'm a tax-paying citizen and doing, you know, I'm not committing any crimes besides perhaps doing the drug itself or doing, you know. And then I'm at the end of the book, I'm happy and fine. I don't end up in rehab. Not to knock people in rehab, but I'm not in rehab. I'm not. It's one of the few books that's non-recalcitrant. I don't apologize for drug use in that book, and good luck finding books out there. Besides Junkie and Huxley's, you know, Doors of Perception, there are not many books at all. Almost every book about somebody doing drugs has to end with that person in rehab or screwing up other people's lives along with screwing up their own and apologizing for their use. And I purposefully, my book does not end that way because it didn't. And my life hasn't ended that way, you know. I don't smoke pot anymore, yeah, but I did a long time, and I did all kinds of drugs over the years. One of the things I would argue, though, is that actually my use of America consumes more drugs, Americans do, than any other country on the planet. And I would say there's people that do a lot more drugs than I did in that book. It's just that I'm being honest about it.
Yeah.
And trying to give a very honest – and so I have friends that say that they want to give that book to their, you know, kid in college as an anti-drug book. You know,
mm-hmm,
and then other people that are, you know, pro drug. Like, in fact, I got more flack from people who like drugs about that book.
Really?
And people in rehab and stuff. I had an interview in this magazine called The Fix. I got all these people writing, you know, why is this guy who still, you know, drinks and, you know, does drugs sometimes, you know, what's he doing in this magazine, you know? Yeah.
They don't approve. Have you ever read Gary Steingart's memoir, Little Failure?
No, I haven't.
I think you'd enjoy that.
He
had a drug period when he was at Oberlin, and he turned out okay.
Yeah.
They called
him
Scary Gary because he got so wild.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of reminds me a little bit of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's the scariest. Some of the worst chapters are in there are the cocaine chapters in the beginning. Those are some of the most graphic sex and graphic violence. And I mention it because those were actually the beginnings of this book, Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions. Earlier versions of this book, those first cocaine chapters were the beginnings of this book, which I just kind of summed that up in the epilogue to this one. I mean, I said that we were drinking and drugging, you know, Susan and I were, for about a year there or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you actually read my book, Drugs, it'll show you exactly what we were doing during that time period.
Oh, my. I'm going to look that one up.
You'll see why we ran out of money.
Right.
You'll see why I ended up, you know, having to take any job I could get.
Mm-hmm.
We were both, you know, pretty desperate there.
These were the Reagan 80s, I take it.
Yeah, the 80s. I was trying to, in Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, I was trying to show another side from the, you know, how the Reagan years were portrayed and everything, usually, you know. Well, they were, at the time, they were portrayed as, you know, everybody's prospering with this trickle-down economic stuff and everything. But
mm-hmm. Voodoo economics, I believe it was called by his vice president. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. these are the people that it didn't trickle down to.
Yeah. My guest is J.R. Helton, and we're talking about his memoir, Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class. I think if I had to pick my favorite section, it's the one that's really different, where you and your brother and a crew of guys are out in rural Kansas doing something rather unusual. Tell us about this job.
Sure, yeah. We started in high school, me and that guy and his brother, picking up railroad ties on the side of the road that the railroad companies discarded, and some of those were still good. And then we'd load them on a big flatbed and then sell them to gardening centers and stuff like that. And so the operation, he just made it bigger and bigger and bigger and started getting contracts. Instead of going out at night and picking them up, getting contracts with the railroad companies to do this. And so this was at the beginning of Alton's business. And he was hiring crews of undocumented workers that were working in really bad conditions. And we would go up to states like Oklahoma and Kansas, but mostly all over Texas, but we went up to Kansas one time. And with a crew of about 15 guys, you know, from Mexico usually. And it was brutal work, you know. We would work for like, you know, 2 weeks straight, seven days a week, you know, from dawn till it got dark. You couldn't see anymore. Picking up these railroad ties and loading them into bundles and then crimping these bundles on a front end loader and then loading those up on semis that would take them out of a central location and sell them wholesale. So, you know, how people have railroad ties is edging around their, mm-hmm. you know, and use them as shoring things up or edging around things. And that's where they were coming from, you know.
I've never tried to move one, but they must be really heavy.
They're very heavy. I have a really bad back now, by the way.
Oh,
I have a terrible
you
back.
Do.
I broke my back even, which is in my next book, How I Broke My Back.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Where do you see my next book?
Was that another bad job?
Oh, listen, I would love to say that after this book ended, I got my act together and never made any more poor decisions and had bad jobs. Things get much worse after this book. My second wife, I made the worst decision. When I met her, she had 3 dogs, and when I left, she had 350 dogs. And I helped her start this no-kill animal sanctuary, and that's what my next book is about. And I ended up almost dying out there. I broke my back, ended up in a trailer filled with rats and stuff. I mean, it was really, really bad. So it's actually much worse than this one. Even though I go back to college at the end of this book and get my degree, I made some really poor decisions after that. But, those railroad ties were heavy, and I didn't put it in the book, but I actually broke my foot on one of those jobs because uh-huh. Alton threw a tie over at me, and it landed on my foot, just glanced my boot, you know, just kind of glanced my work boot, but it was so heavy it broke my left foot. Which still hurts sometimes to this day.
Uh-huh.
But
I'll
yeah,
bet
that
it does.
Was a brutal job. Yeah. And
okay.
I was trying to show, you know, how tough it was for the guys that were working for us too, by the way.
But yeah.
How they had it even worse, you know, much worse.
Well, I love that chapter. You're out in the middle of nowhere. And
right.
It's something kind of meditative and reflective about it.
Thank you. I'm glad you noticed that because I really intended that. The scene where he is in Cassidy, Kansas, he looks at the prairie chicken capital of the world.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to just slow things down there, you know.
Yeah.
He's just right in this moment. He sees this little kid riding his bike down this little, literally, one-street town, you know, in Kansas.
Yeah. Well, I've spent a month in Kansas one day, and it's just one of those places. It's endless. It's just, you get on that turnpike, and you can't get off. It just it's endless.
Yeah. Those plains are kind of – it definitely has a sort of existential – alienation quality to them. You know, you truly feel alone and separate out there, which is the field I was trying to go for in that chapter.
You just mentioned this next book that you're working on, and if I'm understanding the chronology, the first book that you published, Drugs, is actually the third book chronologically. So where does this fourth book fit in? Does it come in after Drugs?
Drugs is my whole life. Like, Drugs is from when I first started smoking pot at like 13 or so, experimenting with it, and then first really getting high is where the book starts. When I was about 17, started getting high and trying, experimenting with a lot of different drugs, all the way up until I was in my mid-40s. So it actually encompasses some of the alcohol chapters.
Okay.
I really started drinking way too much alcohol, and a lot of the alcohol chapters in my second marriage are in Drugs. And so I don't really go into that period, though, in my life. And so I'm taking this that period and turning it into this just the whole rise and fall of the animal sanctuary in my second marriage.
Okay.
And I had with some again with a friend, some friends self-published a shorter version of this my new book under a different title, and I was still married to her when I wrote that. And so I didn't really get to tell the whole story. I didn't really get to talk about the fall of the and truly go into all the details about it, you know. So this, it really descended into a Darwinian madhouse is what I say.
Mm.
And I just don't know any other stories like that out there that the person's not completely crazy themselves. I mean, you know, it was really a truly working 501c3 nonprofit, you know, bringing in a lot of money and all kinds of stuff. So again, I'm going to have to be careful in changing some names and stuff like that in that book.
Bring in the lawyers again, huh?
Okay. Right.
All right. And the second marriage ended up falling apart too. How many times have you been married now?
I'm in my third and last marriage, and this is when my life became stable, when I met my wonderful wife, Carissa, and just like I said, like my life's never been more stable, never better.
Good.
Since 2001, and I got a lot more done. I'm just tired of the chaos that had gone on for so long, you know.
So after 2001, we're not going to get any more memoirs. It's just there's nothing interesting going on.
I have another one called Professor.
Okay.
My life as a professor, but I'm
boring.
I'm taking some of that material. Some of that material in Professor was about when I was on the Animal Sanctuary. So I took it out because Robert Crumb really liked Professor, and I put it into this new book, which is about 325 pages long now, Sanctuary. And Crumb just wrote me December 29th, a month and a half ago, and he flipped out. He loves this new book. He said this absolutely has to be published. And so he really, really likes this new one, Sanctuary. So that's what I'm going to be concentrating on trying to get published next for sure.
I'll never forget discovering R. Crumb. What a guy. You're so lucky to have a friendship with him.
Yeah, he's been like a mentor kind of guy, but also a confidant, you know, somebody that I can, we've been exchanging letters. We've like got several hundred pages of letters. He writes these incredible hard copy letters that we've been exchanging since 1997. And he really just came along at a time that really helped me believe in myself and taught me about what it means to be an artist. He was an artist that I could respect, you know. He was has real sincerity and authenticity. He's a brave artist. He takes chances, you know. So, and we could be really honest with each other, you know. Like, he could really straighten me out. And he forced me to look at myself and look at my behavior, you know, pay attention to what I was saying on the page and what I was saying to him in my letters, you know. And it helped a lot, a whole lot.
Well, it was a revelation when I discovered Zap Comics in high school and discovered his work. And, of course, then I became a fan of Gilbert Sheldon and S. Clay Wilson and all those crazy cartoonists from that period. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners who have been listening to this interview have remembered some of their bad jobs and some of their poor decisions because they're listening to you talk about these terrible things and they're thinking, oh, yeah, well, I had a bad job too, a really bad job. And I was thinking about this myself, and I remember my worst job.
Uh-huh.
A buddy of mine, his father bought him a business manufacturing septic tanks.
Oh, God.
And it was about a 100-year-old operation, essentially in a cave, where he handmade septic tanks in these giant metal molds. And he brought me in there, and they'd be hanging on these rusty chains up in the air, and he'd be curing them. And he'd say, now, he says, I'm paying you cash, he says. And if we have an accident, he says, I don't know you.
That's what you want to hear. That's a horrible job.
Yeah, I lasted about 5 minutes at that job.
Yeah,
so I don't need this.
You were because that was a good decision. But
I
think that's a compliment when people tell me that. Like a lot of people have said to me, we had a big book launch here in San Antonio, and it really went well. And people said this could be the title of my 20s. You know, I said great. That's a compliment. You know.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of us maybe have had bad jobs and made poor decisions. So.
Well, it sounds like you're ready to start shopping this next book. Do you have it finished and a publisher lined up?
The draft is finished, and that I sent it in a hard copy to Crumb, and he wrote me back, and he asked me if he could give it to my current publisher, W.W. Norton. So I said, sure, absolutely.
Crumb asked you if he could give it to Norton. Is he your go-between? How's that work?
Well, my agent would probably fish about me, and he's very excited about this book. So, I mean, who knows? He might, you know, like personally hand it to him. He's done that before, things like that for me. He might just give it to his agent and mine, and they'll mail it to him or something, you know. But he knows the top people, you know, the big editors there and stuff. And
have you ever met him in person?
Robert?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, my wife and I have stayed at his their villa in the south of France.
Have you really?
Yeah, they have this beautiful we weren't going to go over there last summer, and then this summer we just don't have a chance. It's hard for me to get away, my wife to get away at the same time, but we're definitely going to go stay with them again soon. They have this beautiful... They live in this little village in the south of France there, and he's got grandkids now that I would like to meet. I mean, since we've been there now, his daughter has some grandkids. And
she's a cartoonist, isn't she?
Yeah, she's really cool. We're friends on Facebook, she and I are, and she's really cool. And I've actually never met Sophie in person.
Oh.
But Robert, my wife and I stay with Robert and Aline, and they're like the best host in the world, you know, just really nice people. And they've always got a lot of people, at least when we were there, you know, people dropping in and visiting all the time. They're very generous and kind host, you know.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy. He's like super sober, you know. He's been like, he doesn't even drink like caffeinated coffee for 20-something years, you know. He doesn't drink or anything. He's like real... He's not really like the image sometimes that people have of him from those Zap comic days, you know, that time period.
Well, JR, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your work.
Hey, I really enjoyed it too, Vic. I appreciate you talking to me.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been JR Helton. The book is Bad Jobs and Poor Decisions, Dispatches from the Working Class. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.